Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much for that news update, Greg. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Right now on this day in 1882, the Pacific Stock Exchange would open. In 1947, on this day, the CIA would officially go live, as President Truman would have established it in July of the same year. In 1961, on this day, the UN Secretary General at the time would pass away tragically in a plane crash, along with the second Secretary General and 15 other individuals. I suppose that's why they don't have high-profile people flying together. If they belong to the same organization, this would make sense. In 1964, on this day, the Addams Family series would be released. It would run for two seasons. In 1971, on this day, a gentleman by the name of Manufuku Ando would be, or would actually market the first ever cup noodles, as we know them today, as instant noodles. He was a Taiwanese gentleman who is known as the inventor of instant noodles. In 1997, on this day, Ted Turner would donate $1 billion to the United Nations, thus creating the United Nations Foundation. In 1998, on this day, we'd get rush hour. In 1999, South Africa would win the most amount of medals at the 7th annual All-Africa Games. Get to this, winning 180 medals. I don't know if we've done anything since then. To that extent, rather. In 2018, on this day, just to show you how the world operates in very strange ways, China would impose $60 billion worth of tariffs on U.S. goods following, or the very next day after, the U.S. had imposed $200 billion of tariffs on Chinese goods. And at the exact same time, or rather on the exact same day, South Africa would elect to legalize the use of cannabis in private homes. You're tuning to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we take a look at the developments around the inflation space. We got inflation print from South Africa, from the UK, as well as from the EU today, and we're expecting interest rates a little later on from the US. We're going to be speaking to the Matrix Fund Managers teams around how they're seeing the inflation picture, whether or not we could be in for an adjustment on that inflation re-anchoring, and the concerns around that. And then we've got a conversation with Standard Bank around their latest offering for family-owned businesses and local businesses looking to expand their operations. They've introduced a new product through their Mauritian business that businesses can take advantage of there. We've also got a conversation with the team at Kaspersky around cybersecurity and understanding how you can best protect your company and what a breach of cybersecurity, or a cyber attack rather, could cost your company beyond just the financial implications. And then we've got a conversation with Alan Gray around the South African equity market. We've seen a couple of days of really good price movements and really good recoveries. Today wasn't such a good day, but it looks as though the general sense of optimism still remains within the market, and we're going to look and see if we can try and figure out how long that'll be around for. And because it's Wednesday, we've got an executive lounge feature on a Wednesday. We're going to be chatting to a gentleman by the name of Werner Abrahams, who is the CEO of IKUSASA Student Financial Aid Program. He joins me in studio to get a sense of what he does at IKUSASA and what he's looking forward to about now moving to Johannesburg.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Before we get into all of that, let's look at how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam, a private wealth, Nick Kunz, to take a look at the market movements of the day. Nick, lovely to speak to you again. We had a good start to the week. We had a good end to last week. And today just seems like midweek reversals definitely came in.
Yeah, evening, Jimmy. Evening to your listeners. Yeah, spot on there. It just seems like we're running out a little bit of steam, as you said. Had a really good few sessions. And then ahead of what I think you mentioned in the intro, ahead of tonight, a couple of big central bank decisions, including our own Saab tomorrow, market just treading a little bit of water. And in fact, if you drill down into the volumes today, we did about $15.5 billion. Give that a perspective, we're normally averaging 20 to 25. So really, I think a lot of investors just sitting on their hands and waiting this week.
There were a couple of data points that came out today as well, Nick. UK CPI, European CPI, mm-hmm. South African CPI. So a lot of data for the markets to digest, in addition to, of course, that big FOMC rates announcement that we're expecting in a couple of hours.
Yeah, so I mean, so if you look down at those CPI number, those PPI numbers, and the CPI numbers here in South Africa, you know, these are all your sort of inflation prints that the central banks really sort of watch, and that's been the general sort of, I guess, rhetoric from the central banks the last few years is fighting this inflation curse, but it's come down significantly, Jimmy. I mean, look at our CPI, for example, now sitting at 4.4% year on year. Market was looking for about 4.5%, and those who sort of follow the markets realize this is slightly less than the 3 to 6% sort of halfway band that our SARB is looking for. So certainly going in the right direction. And you know, Mr. Kanyagi and his team obviously looked at this, and you know, they're going to take a look favorably on this the softer inflation number.
Nick, when we look at the markets locally, at least today, we look at resources. They had 4 days of really, really good recoveries. It looks as though we've kind of broken that four-day streak with the negative performance today. But is this kind of just markets saying we've run for a little bit of time, there must be some cooling off? Or is there a genuine concern that we might get a surprise either from the Fed or from the SARB, or are markets concerned about anything?
Well, I mean, if you just look at, if you look at some of these, you mentioned the platinum and the miners and the PGM space. I mean, if you look at what some of these counters have done the last week or two, I mean, some of them are up, you know, almost a third, you know, 30-odd%. You know, so you understand, and you're going to give a little bit back at some point. You can't, you know, continuously grind higher, and I think we saw that today. And I mentioned the volumes. I wouldn't read too much into it. Are there going to be some surprises? I'm not sure. You know, you've got to keep an eye on this dollar. Everything's about the dollar at the moment. And the rand, we haven't even spoken about that. You know, under 1760 at the moment. That is also a bit of a weaker dollar, sort of knocking around that parity level at the dollar index. So it's all about what happens to the Fed tonight, 8 o'clock, for those who are interested. You know, depending how big that rate cut's going to be. 0.25% already priced in. Markets looking for, some market watchers talking about a 50 basis point cut from the Fed tonight.
Nick, we saw financial sector stocks in South Africa performing quite positively, and typically when we kind of go into these uncertain times, your financial sector stocks, your banks sort of come across as the defensive stocks, and markets kind of go there because where the interest rates go up or down, the banks are kind of insulated from that. How are we reading just the expectations around the rate cuts? Are you seeing 50 basis points from your side? You think 25% is more realistic? What does it look like?
So, I mean, it is a tricky one. I mean, and to your point, Jimmy, I mean, financials tend to sort of lead markets. They're really good leading indicators. And our banks have been pretty decent. I mean, a soggy sort of day like today, and Standard Bank's actually in the green quite nicely, 240 at the moment, 240 rand a share. You know, they also, our banks are well capitalized. They're not expensive. They're giving some nice dividend yields. So you understand where the flows go. And again, to your point, you know, a little bit of defensive play. What is the SARB going to do tomorrow? It's a tricky one. You know, I could argue at length and why they could easily do 50 basis points. You know, going from 8.25% to 8%. On an interest rate cut, it's not really going to move the needle. And if you look at those inflation numbers today, and you look at where our sort of 10-year bond is, you know, sitting around about 9%, I mean, that's giving real rates at 4%. That puts us as one of the most expensive sort of places in the world with real rates. I think they could go for more, but you know, MPC is notoriously hawkish, so I don't think they're going to, yeah, I don't think they're going to shake things up too much, probably a quarter.
Probably 25 basis points from that perspective. What does that then mean for the outlook for some of the other sectors going into the rest of the year? Are you feeling that we might see some optimism from the likes of our retailers as we sort of see consumer spend potentially increase, or we see consumer sentiment sort of relax or take a bit of a breather from all the stress and tension it's been under?
Yeah, well, if you look at that consumer number, the confidence number that came out yesterday, it was still negative, but it was certainly moving in the right direction. So, you know, looking okay. In general, though, I definitely feel like there's definitely a little bit of a positive tailwind to the markets. You know, you've got to look at the two things. Look at the rand dollar as a barometer, Jimmy, and also look at the 10-year notes. Both of that with money coming into those two asset classes, which does bode well. And then looking at the broader market, the retailers, the general SA Inc. also getting a positive tailwind. And then also don't underestimate, load shedding for these businesses. You know, someone like ShopRite spent, I think, 900 million rand on diesel last financial year. And so far in the last 3-4 months, they've spent nothing. It's straight to the bottom line. So that's also very, very positive for these retailers.
So lots to be optimistic about at this stage. Nick, what are you optimistic about? Are there any particular sectors you are liking at the moment?
So I continue to favour that sort of SA Inc. space. So, you know, there is, as Transnet slowly, I believe, coming right, as we've already spoken about Eskom, you know, these miners tend to be, you know, looking a little bit okay at the PGM space. I think the more sort of the industrial sector, I think, is due a little bit of love. I think this it's had a bit of a bounce. I think it can do more. And on a relative basis, if you had to sort of compare us with our emerging market peers, you know, South African market, South African shares still looking a little bit on the cheaper side. So I do think if the good news continues and we still have this optimism flowing, I think the industrials have quite a bit more upside. And also, just to finish up, Jimmy, you know, you forget we've had 10 years of going sideways, you know, 3-4 months of getting it right. You know, don't jump out yet. There's still quite a bit left in this, I think.
it's very soon. It's too soon to get overly excited. We've got to stay cautious about these things. Nick, what about the Rand? Can we be optimistic about the Rand? I saw it closer to that 1750 level. We've had analysts say we might even get to 17 or even 1682. How are we feeling about the Rand?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think so. If you look at a relative basis, and all we can do is compare it to the peers, and so the Fed might surprise with a bigger rate cut. And in general, our rate, I've mentioned the real rates, our real rates are far too high. But saying that they are going to be cautious on their rate cutting, so I think we are still going to get those flows. And there's also big, big demand for the South African government bonds coming from offshore, you know, looking very attractive with our dollar-denominated debt, our rand-denominated debt. We don't have dollar-denominated debt as much. So that's also a positive. So I think you could see this rand strengthen back towards 17 or just under 17 in the near term, definitely.
Cautious optimism. It's all in the data and it's all in the information that's going to come out. Thanks so much for the time, Nick. We'll leave it at that. That's Nick Kunz, Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, joining me to reflect on the market movements as well as what the market might be thinking at the moment.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The local equity market has delivered muted returns in recent years as structural challenges, including load shedding and persistently weak economic growth, fostered a difficult environment. With the elections behind us and the government of unity finding its feet, many investors are taking a new look at South African equities. Join the SAFM Market Update this evening at 6:45 as Alan Gray Portfolio Manager Tim Acker delves into the local equities market's prospects, exploring the challenges and the opportunities. Brought to you by Alan Gray. 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And sticking with those data points that we discussed with Nick, the inflation prints that came out today, we got South African inflation that suggests that inflation has come in below the midpoint for the first time in a very long time. And we thought we'd take a look at that and see what that means for the overall picture in SA, but also potentially for that re-anchoring conversation that we don't really want to have with the Reserve Bank governor. I'm joined on the line by the macroeconomist and fixed income strategist at Matrix Fund Managers, Kim Silberman, to take a look at this. Good evening, Kim. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the U.S. picture. Obviously, that is such a central picture and has been so instrumental and pivotal to how other central banks are making their decisions. And we know we've got that U.S. central bank decision or the U.S. Fed rates announcement a little later on this evening. Are we feeling optimistic?
Good evening, Jimmy. Yes, I mean, it depends what you're expecting. So I think I reckon they'll cut by 25 basis points, but the market is hoping for something between 25 and 50. So either way, I suppose they might be disappointed. But it's the start of a rate cutting cycle, and I think that's really, from a macro perspective, that's important that we've turned a corner, and it means that the Saab can also turn a corner.
Kim, when we look at that conversation around the Saab turning a corner, let's look at the inflation picture. We got our inflation print in for the first time, bang in line with where it should be and where is comfortable for the Saab, but as we know with these data points, they tend to come in a little later. They're sort of lagging behind, or they take a bit of time to actually be felt in the market in real time. So when we look at the latest inflation print, is that going to give comfort to the Saab, or are they going to want to see more data that suggests that inflation is under control?
No, I think, you know, we've had a massive drop in inflation. It's come down from 7.8%. To 4.5% or just below. So I, from that perspective, from an inflation perspective, I think, you know, since the May meeting, the Saab itself has commented or stated that our monetary policy is restrictive. So they're well aware that it's restrictive, and their major concern was that, you know, U.S. rates were also high. And the differential between our rates and the U.S. rates determines the strength of the currency. I mean, there are other things that determine the strength of the currency, such as commodity prices and our structural risks. But a big part of the of our currency is to do with that differential between our interest rate and the U.S. interest rate.
Go ahead, Kim.
No, I'm just saying, so because the, you know, we could have cut, I think, earlier, but the Saab was very well aware that it needed to maintain that differential, and so it has been waiting for the Fed to start cutting.
Looking at that differential, if the Fed comes out tomorrow with 50 basis points as a cut, we kind of don't see more than 25 basis points from a South African perspective. What does that do towards the differential? I imagine it skews it ever so slightly in favor of the Rand, but is it to the detriment of consumers?
Yeah, no, you're right. It does. And, you know, I think not really. That's not, as with economics, it's not a straight answer. But essentially, if you have a stronger Rand, then that's good for consumers. And I think what's important to bear in mind when we try and understand the Saab and its communication and its decisions, we need to think about the consumer in a disaggregated way. So for the Saab, you know, there's 20 million people in South Africa that are on social grants, and around, you know, 30 million that probably are not exposed to mortgage debt and exposed to high interest rates. And so for that sector of the economy, it's really inflation that allows that the largest portion of our consumers to spend more. So the lower inflation is the food, fuel, public transport, rent, all of those things have come down because of high interest rates, and the majority of our population benefit from that. Maybe it's at the expense of those with debt, but I think our Reserve Bank is a lot more concerned about those who are closer to the breadline than those who have debt.
Kim, when we look at the Saab conversation, we've heard before that the governor wants to revisit this re-anchoring conversation from a long-term perspective to no longer consider 4.5% as the midpoint, but to actually bring that down potentially between the 2% to 3% range. When we compare that with things like the uninverting yield curve in the US that suggests that we could be in for a US recession at some point, How do we understand this data? How is it important for the Saab to then, one, look at our own alignment of policy, but also the timing around that and say, if we are to see a U.S. recession, is now the best time to be adjusting this, or should we be looking at this at another time?
So I mean, if we did see a U.S. recession, I think the oil price would come down. So, it, you know, from that perspective, it would be easier to target a lower inflation rate. But I also, from an economic perspective, targeting a lower inflation rate makes a lot of sense. Our trading partners are also at 3% inflation, and that would really protect the value of the currency. And I think maybe what isn't as well publicized in the media, is if the Saab had to lower the target to 3%. It would do so over a period of 3-4 years. And if we think about what that would mean in 4 years' time, is that, you know, if you lower the inflation target by 1.5 percentage points, you can then lower the interest rates on a structural basis by 1.5 percentage points. So you would, over 4 years, I would reckon if you targeted a 3% inflation rate, you could have much lower inflation and lower interest rates and more certainty and investment because lower inflation and rates feeds through into so many parts of the economy in a positive way.
In addition to the investment side of it, from a positivity perspective, what would lower rates then mean for things like economic growth? I mean, we have greater capital investment, certainly, but businesses in South Africa that are in debt would also have an easier time, surely.
Yes, correct. And those consumers that I was referring to, those who are not employed on social grants, salary and income does not increase with inflation at the best of times. So they would really benefit from lower inflation as well. But it's also around if you've got lower inflation, that feeds into a stronger currency, it feeds into lower debt costs for our government. And as you said, it provides a whole lot of certainty to investors who are then not, you know, they're not trying to cope with the volatile inflation rate going forward.
Certainly a very interesting perspective around what the future of South Africa could look like under a different inflation targeting mechanism or inflation targeting mandate. We'll leave it at that. Kim, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Kim Silberman, who is a macroeconomist and fixed income strategist at Matrix Fund Managers, joining me to take a look at the inflation picture in South Africa as well as around the world.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. It's the private banking service we are known for, now available for your business. Because you never settle for ordinary, neither should your business. Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary. Investec Bank Limited, a registered credit and authorized financial services provider. You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
If you know anything about South African and African businesses, you'll know that a lot of them are family-owned or family-founded businesses. Most of them, the likes of Dis-Chem, start out as an endeavor between various members of a family with a founder. Pick and Pay is another example. And along the way, the business gets a little bigger and a little bigger. And before you know it, it is a business that services multiple regions and multiple areas. Interestingly enough, when these businesses look to operate, typically they have found difficulties operating beyond South Africa's borders if they don't have the right infrastructure in place. Thankfully, Standard Bank has a solution for this. Standard Bank Business and Commercial Banking has launched just today, a couple of hours ago, in fact, the latest offering for their clients from the Standard Bank Mauritius business. I'm joined on the line by Oscar Seziba, who is Head of Business Banking Coverage at Standard Bank Business and Commercial Banking, to take a look at this. Oscar, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Take us through the latest product launch and why Mauritius?
Thank you so much, and good afternoon to you and your listeners. We are extremely excited about launching our offerings in Mauritius. Mauritius is in the continent. It's a well-established economy with really competitive advantages for African businesses that want to operate in these established markets. I think generally you find that, you know, our clients in the continent had to go across continents to go and do these type of businesses. I think, you know, Mauritius does give a platform for African businesses to have really top of the market services, international services, that gives them a stable environment to operate, strong current support in terms of dealing with some of the challenges we face in the continent. But really, it's really focused on taking our clients into these well-established international finance centers that is now available in our own continent. And that's really what is exciting for us. And these are some of the key benefits that Mauritius provide to our African businesses that wants to go globally, leveraging our own international finance center.
Oscar, when we look at the South African businesses, or the African businesses rather, as you said, that look to expand and look to enter into global territories, what are some of the considerations from a support perspective and from a needs perspective that Standard Bank is looking to service here?
Let me probably some of the key benefits is that Mauritius is a gateway to engage in international trade and investment, provides a much more stable, well-regulated, that supports business growth and wealth protection. The macroeconomic is stable in Mauritius compared to some of the markets we have, and it does address some of the macroeconomic challenges that most of our clients that operate in the continent experiences, such as the significant current devaluations, inflationary pressures, liquidity challenges that are experienced by many, many businesses that are trying to do business. And all of these challenges negatively impact the operations of our clients in a range of sectors. So when we look at Mauritius, it serves as that strategic hub for African businesses to protect their world, give them access to working capital in midst of all of these challenges that are faced by most businesses that come from our continent.
A very interesting innovation from the continent's leading bank, that is Standard Bank. Thank you so much, Oscar, for the time and for the insights. That's Oscar Seziba, who is the head of business banking coverage at Standard Bank Corporate and Business Banking, joining me to reflect on their latest introduction into the market, or their latest offering to the market, for family-owned businesses and local corporates looking to expand globally.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
From product offerings, we move on to warnings. We try to do these Warning Wednesday features as often as we can. This week, we're taking a look at cybersecurity, cyber attacks, and what a cyber attack or cybersecurity breach could potentially mean for your business. I'm joined on the line by Principal Security Researcher at Kaspersky, David M., to take a look at this. Good evening, David. Thanks so much for taking the time. Yesterday, we had a conversation with Itala Bank around the systems that they have in place. And one of the things that came out of that conversation was that banks are not immune to cyber attacks. We've seen cyber attacks be more and more prevalent in the banking and in businesses in general in South Africa. What kinds of attacks do we need to be aware of? Where do we start by understanding what these cyber attacks look like?
Well, I think the starting point really for any organization is to look at what their assets are and to do an audit of those assets, and to look at, on the back of that, what their risks are. So what important information have we got? What intellectual property do we have? What customer information? What partner information? And if somebody wanted to attack it, how do they get in and get that? So you sort of play the attacker, put yourself in their position, or indeed, if you haven't got the expertise, you go out to, say, a penetration tester organization and say, look, if you were to get into our organization, how would you do it? So any organization, as you said, can be potentially at risk, because any organization is sitting on top of very valuable data.
David, when we look at cyber attacks, most of the time, I think the general perception or misconception at this point is that it's just the financial damage that comes along with it. But let's look at some of the other things that come with being the victim or on the receiving end of a cyber attack.
Sure. I mean, you're right about the financial thing, and there's no question that is significant sometimes. You think about a ransomware attack, for example, where they're literally trying to extort money. It's obvious that's going to be kind of uppermost in everybody's mind. And when you think about the impact on that organization, that's going to be the first thing you think of. But you're right, there are all kinds of different impacts. You know, if we think, for example, about the operational disruption, the fact that there might be downtime associated with an attack where people can't be productive, you think about also the impact in terms of IT. So, you know, you need to take measures to recover from an attack. That sucks up kind of IT resource. And so while there might be downtime, there's also kind of IT chasing this where they could be doing other productive things. On top of that, you know, you think about the reputational damage as well on the organization. Especially if you think in terms of, you know, financial organizations in particular, but actually any organization relies really on having a standing among its customers and among the wider community. If it suffers a computer breach, let's say customer data is lost, let's say lots of other information gets spilled out online, that also can have a big impact, you know, because it looks to the rest of the world as though you aren't able to protect your assets and potentially other people's assets as well. On top of that, I suppose you would look at legal issues too. You know, you think in Europe, there's the General Data Protection Regulation. In South Africa, there's POPIA. You think about HIPAA in the US. So there can be fines as a result of mishandling data as perceived, you know, if there is some sort of data breach. And then I guess the other one, the final thing I would make here is, in terms of the company's own intellectual property, it might be your forward strategy. It might be particular know-how that you've got nobody else has in the marketplace. If somebody is able to get access to that and steal it, clearly that is removing your USP to the world, really.
David, how do we best prepare a business for this? I mean, in the event that we haven't been able to stress test the vulnerabilities to identify those, what do we do from a business perspective if we might feel like the business has been exposed or there might be a data breach that we're not really certain of, but we don't really want to make the situation worse? What kind of steps can we put in place?
Well, I mean, most organizations now will employ technology as a way of keeping attackers out or trying to keep attackers out. Increasingly, though, I think the emphasis has shifted and is shifting away from trying to assume you can build a defensive wall and keep people out to actually let's work on the principle that somebody has got in. And if they have, we need, if you like, listeners around the organization where we can tap into activity that doesn't look normal for us as a sign that something might be going on. So you're leaving lots of kind of fly papers around in the hope that something is picked up, some echo on the system, on the radar, which doesn't look normal. I think if you think there is, then it's a question of either scrambling your own in-house resources to look for that, to go threat hunting, or calling in an outside agency if you don't have that expertise. And I think, as I said, it increasingly we're looking at sort of proactive capabilities, you know, not just in terms of looking for network intrusions, but also getting the inside track on what attackers are doing. And that means really threat intelligence, getting threat intelligence into the organization that you can look at to determine, you know, what the possible risks are and what you can do to deal with them. And I think also, you know, you mentioned there about, you know, the situation if there's an attack going on, it's really important for any organization to have an incident response plan. And as part of that, that's going to include things like who are the key people who we need to get involved. And that's got to include not just IT, but, you know, the legal team, the corporate communications team as well. It's got to include the HR department. And it really means having a plan and monitoring it on a regular basis to make sure that it's up to date. Because the last thing you want when the balloon goes up is that actually some of the people who were in your incident response plan have moved on. They're not there anymore. So I think having that living plan that kind of evolves as you as a company do is really, really critical. And that's got to include even internal communications, because if you think, for example, about a ransomware attack, it might well be that by the time they issue a ransom demand to you, they are so embedded in your organization that anything you do, any communication channel you open, they are privy to that. And therefore, having an emergency communications plan which says, look, if we're in the middle of an incident, we switch to XYZ communication method, which we don't normally use, so that we know we're not being listened to by the people we think are attackers in the organization.
David, that emergency plan sounds like a really good idea. Is it worthwhile to explore having, as part of that emergency plan, things like off-site data backups or removing some information or sensitive information from a cloud-based backup system and rather having the traditional methods of backups that we have? Or are cloud services fairly secure at the moment?
Well, I mean, we see cases where they're not, and it's not necessarily because the provider isn't secure. It's because maybe somebody hasn't configured one of these cloud buckets properly, and therefore data is accessible. And I think on the whole, you know, we need to look at the cloud as we would look at our own organization and to say, well, if we were storing something on site somewhere, what steps would we take in terms, let's say, of encryption of data or two-factor authentication for accessing it, limiting access to only those people who need it, and so on. And I think we need to take the same approach to the cloud. So if it's sensitive data that you would encrypt on site, you should be looking at doing the same when it's in the cloud as well. I think also there's sometimes a danger that when we outsource the provision in terms of data management, we think we're also outsourcing the security. And I think we need to be careful about that. We need to have those security discussions with our cloud provider, but we need to realize that it's our data. We need to take the relevant steps to make sure that it stays safe. So I think definitely looking at that, looking at also, you know, I've mentioned ransomware a couple of times because it's one of the prominent threats these days. But if you have an attack which leaks data, damages data, prevents you accessing the data, you need a way of being able to recover that data without having to pay some huge ransomware fee, which actually may not result in you getting the data back because, let's face it, we're dealing with crooks. So having that sort of backup plan is important. Having backups stored unconnected and having them also probably stored in some form off-site, just in case of fire or flood and things like that, is also important. I think the final thing as well is just making sure that your staff are aware of this. You know, having an education plan such that people are aware. And it's not turning people into experts. It's just laying out for them, look, if we get attacked, it might well start with you. It might start with a phishing email. It might start with some other approach. So here's what we all need to think of in order to make our broader security posture more resilient.
Be prepared and make sure you've got the relevant conversations, teams and structures in place so that this does not become a problem you cannot handle. I will leave it at that, David. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. David M., Principal Security Researcher at Kaspersky, joining me to take a look at cybersecurity and how to navigate a cyber attack.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This segment is brought to you by Allan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. We're seeing mid-week reversals, we've spoken about them, but there is still a general sense of optimism in the markets, especially in the South African space. And I'm joined on the line by the portfolio manager at Allan Gray, Tim Acker, to take a look at these opportunities, this optimism, and how you could potentially take advantage of these movements. Good evening, Tim. Lovely to speak to you again. The local markets have been great since the elections, barring a couple of worrying data points from around the world, but overall sentiment seems to have improved.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Jimmy. It's nice to be here. And good evening, listeners. There's definitely been an improvement in sentiment on the local market, so that's very clear. But I think it's also good to remember where we're coming from, right? So the South African market has not been a great performer over the last 2 years. We've been about flat in rand terms. So we had a bit of a recovery a few years ago from COVID, but we've underperformed the world market. And certainly at the start of the year, I think investors were actually, you know, quite depressed, you know, local investors. And foreign investors were not very keen on the South African market, so they weren't really interested at all, especially given the election, but also all the other issues we know about. So actually the market had been performing quite poorly until before the election.
Tim, we saw the election go off with virtually without a hitch by comparison when we compare to other elections that we thought it could have turned out as. But in addition to that, we've actually had electricity in the country. What has that done for international sentiment and international viewpoints on the South African market? And are we seeing a lot more positivity from a capital deployment perspective coming into SA markets?
I think so. So in investing and in markets, one can say low expectations can be quite powerful, right? When people don't expect a lot of you, it doesn't take a lot to surprise them in a positive way, right? And that's what we've seen in South Africa. So the, as I mentioned, the expectations from foreign investors and from locals was quite low for the South African stock market and the economy. And so now we've had the election, and as you say, it went off without a hitch. So that's a big positive for foreign investors, just that sort of, you know, nothing crazy happens in the election. Regardless of one's politics, I think from the market's perspective, it was a reasonably positive outcome. So sort of a centrist kind of coalition, which the market and especially foreigners see as quite positive. So we've seen the local market rally about 10% since May, so in the last 4 months, which is not too bad. But then especially the South African stocks have, of course, done much better than that, right? So the overall market is up about 10%, but, you know, many of the South African stocks are up a lot more than that. So if you think of the banks, for example, they're up, you know, call it 25%. And that's just, you know, those things you mentioned. So positive election outcome and just some of these negative things not, you know, repeating. So load shedding, for example, just not having load shedding for a few months, suddenly sentiment is a lot more positive, businesses are a lot more positive, and that's obviously positive for the stock market.
Tim, we're not out of the woods yet. We still have to fix a couple of things. We still have to sort out things like our logistics infrastructure, make sure that we continue down the path of our green transition as we have started down that path, I suppose. What are the things that, or the challenges that still persist that might be stopping South African markets or SA Inc. from achieving its full potential?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that point. So one can probably say we're still in the honeymoon phase, right? So we've got a new government and suddenly there's sort of a bit of optimism. We haven't had load shedding for a while, so, you know, consumers just feel a little bit better. But of course, we still have lots of problems in South Africa, right, that all of us know about. So Eskom is not a solved problem. We still have issues with Transnet and roads and water and municipalities, and, you know, you can just go down the list, right? And then we have structural problems like education, and all these things take lots of time to solve. So they're not going to get solved overnight. So really now it's going to come down to execution. So there's some optimism on, you know, maybe things are sort of improving a little bit. And for sure, we're coming from a low base, so it's not like we need to turn the country around tomorrow. You know, you can just make a few improvements and pick some of the low-hanging fruit, and that'll definitely help. But the proof will really be in the pudding, right? So the execution is not going to be easy. We know from experience, you know, in municipalities and provinces over the last few years, that coalition governments can be quite dysfunctional. So we'll see how that goes with the government of national unity and whether they're up to the task.
Tim, what about the companies that are making the most of the cards they've been dealt? We know that different sectors are performing differently. We've seen sectors like PGMs come under a lot of pressure. Some might even say they've been oversold. How are companies kind of sitting there saying, we're making the most of the cards we've been dealt, and those companies, is that where the opportunity lies?
Yeah, so the PGMs, the platinum group metals, are an interesting one in that they really exposed to global commodity prices. So there are some things they can control, their costs and their production, but they really can't control the prices at which they sell. So that, you know, does make them probably sort of slightly lower quality businesses. But then if we think of some of the other South African businesses, so just think of the retailers, the clothing and grocery retailers, or the industrial companies in SA, you know, those companies have been through a very tough period. So over the last 5 or 10 years, as we all know, the economy has been quite tough for a number of years. And those businesses are actually quite resilient, right? So they've had to cut their costs. They've really had to tighten their belts, you know, even before COVID, but then obviously throughout COVID as well. So they actually, you know, many of these businesses run quite lean operations. And what one can expect is if you then see a little bit of revenue growth coming through, so let's say the economy improves slightly, we have slightly faster GDP growth, you know, actually given that lean cost base, you know, that's quite powerful for your earnings. If you're already running quite low costs, actually that, you know, comes down to the bottom line and is actually quite powerful for earnings. So that's, I think, maybe what one could potentially see for some of these SA Inc. businesses, where actually they could do quite well if the economy starts growing a little bit faster.
Tim, is that how you guys are seeing it from a portfolio perspective? Sticking to sort of fundamentals, running as lean exposure as possible in the market and saying, we're focusing on the good quality businesses, we're not going to overload a portfolio, and that's probably the best way to succeed at this point.
Yeah, I think there are actually different opportunities in the market. So it's interesting that category I was talking about. So African businesses exposed to consumers, we definitely still see opportunities in that space. And of course, what we do in the Allan Gray Investment Team is we're focusing on the fundamentals of each business, right? And each business in each industry is different. And you have all these headlines about elections and, you know, where's the economy going and all these things. But really what we focused on is the fundamentals of each business and trying to figure out, you know, what it's worth. And that might be, you know, as we spoke about now, you know, buying consumer businesses. It could be that, you know, you actually have some businesses in South Africa which have done well despite the tough economy, right? So businesses that have won market shares. Outsurance is an example of that, right? The business that has done phenomenally well even, you know, in a tough economy. Or you could have turnaround, you know, businesses which haven't done well, but maybe, you know, they have some internal things they can fix and actually can do well in that way. So there's actually sort of a number of different opportunities that, you know, or ways to play this in the market at the moment.
Things certainly are looking up for SA Inc. And we hope the optimism continues and the markets continue to respond positively. We'll leave it at that, Tim. Thanks so much, as always, for the time. Always a great conversation. Tim Acker, Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray.
This segment was brought to you by Allan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So once again, time for our Executive Lounge feature on a Wednesday, where we speak to leading executives in and around the country and the world, whoever we can get in touch with and get hold of and get a better sense of who they are when they're not running all these important organizations. This week's executive has taken the time and the effort to come join me in studio. The executive in question is the CEO of the IKUSASA Student Financial Aid Program Foundation, Varna Abrams. Good evening, Varna. Thanks so much for coming through to studio. What is IKUSASA? Let's start there. Let's understand, obviously it's a financial aid program, but what is it and how is it different from what we traditionally know as NSFIS?
Okay. Good afternoon, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. And also, it was a pleasure coming through. So IKUSASA literally means the future in Zulu. So IKUSASA, Student Financial Aid Program, we really basically cater for the missing middle income band of students. And that means your household income is between 350,000 and 600,000. What also distinguishes us from NSFAS, so NSFAS, they cater for a household income up to 350,000, but they obviously only provide tuition, accommodation, and then allowances for meals, etc. So what differs, what separates the IKUSASA Student Financial Aid Program, and I'm going to call it ISFAP after this,
<That's fine>.
is that we also provide not only a monetary value in terms of a student's education, but we also provide wraparound support. So that means where students can then get academic support, be it tutoring or support with regards to their personal circumstances, whatever they're going through, as well as psychological support or report writing. So really, by the time you are an ISFAP graduate, you are a well-rounded individual with emotional intelligence and thus adding to our economy as a whole.
I remember when I was studying at Varsity and we were having these conversations around the missing middle, and there was no one that kind of really catered to that. It's nice to see that an organization has found that space to actually service students and to actually make the lives of South Africans a little bit better. When we look at just what you do as ISFAP, what NSFIS does and all of that, I want to look at the importance of your roles in the educational landscape. I mean, surely it's critical to have these things in place, because we've seen that we don't have enough people that can afford to go for tertiary and higher education, and that's kind of where you come in.
Yeah, exactly. So, like I said, our role is also to not only provide financial aid, but to develop the individual as well when while they're busy studying. So our role and what we do and what separates us from NSFAS is that well-rounded individual that comes into the workplace, immediately makes an impact in terms of the support that they've been given through Varsity, i.e. they're maturing throughout the university life cycle, coming into the workplace, and also it's important for the country because now they're adding to our tax base. So as you know, within the country there's a lot of unemployment, there's a lot of citizens using financial support in terms of whatever government gives in terms of allowances or SASSA, whatever support they get from government. So the more graduates we actually get through the system in terms of the throughput rates at the university and them actually adding value to organizations when they graduate and then adding to our tax base, and that adds to Treasury's coffers again, and Treasury's coffers also gets allocated to NSFAS. So I see as an important partner together with NSFAS, they supplying the 350,000 household income band, and we between 350 and 600,000, as well as in that kind of full circle coming back as a student then graduates, adding to the tax base, and then Treasury has more budget to then spend on higher education. So I think that's an important factor in that sense.
Varna, how does a chartered accountant get into education? Was it always a thing you wanted to do? How did that happen?
Yeah. So So growing up, both my parents were teachers, as well as I had an uncle who was a dean at Fort Hare University. Another uncle was a subject advisor at Western Cape Education Department. So our Sundays was really always family gatherings, and at that family gatherings, having tea and cake, there was always discussion around education. Sometimes debates around whatever new curriculum was instituted at the time. Thus, growing up, those were the kind of conversations I heard. I also saw, obviously, the enormous joy that those like aunts or uncles or parents at the time derived from, you know, educating and the students or the learners that they were talking about, that they were teaching, and how they then after they matriculated always came back to the school and say, teacher, I'm not doing this, you were always a great help, stuff like that. So that always inspired me. So when the call came just after I qualified as a chartered accountant, about 2 years in, I was at Nedbank at the time, and then the call came from a family friend, actually, who said there was a college back in Cape Town, West Coast Stevet College. They were looking for a financial manager at the time, and I went for the interview, and then it just all came natural. In terms of when I went for the interview, I immediately grasped the concepts. I understood the higher education landscape, obviously being a student myself also before that. So that primary school, listening to the adult conversations at the family table, that really probably embedded something in me. So by the time that call came and I went for the interview, it was just a natural fit. And then I've been in higher education ever since.
We're going to take a brief pause here because, unfortunately, we've run out of time. We're going to get ready to cross back to the SAFM team for the latest round of evening news. But we're definitely going to finish off this conversation in the meantime, and we're going to put up the full conversation as a podcast on our platforms. So be sure to go visit that conversation, or go listen to that conversation rather, on all our platforms after the show. It's coming up to 7 o'clock. As I said, we're going to cross back to Greg Hurst for the latest round of evening news. He's going to be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. The MoneyWeb app is available for you to listen to the rest of the conversation that I'm going to be having with Werner Abrams. He's the CEO at IKUSASA Student Financial Aid Program. But for now, it's 7 o'clock, so good night.